Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion by Robert Cialdini. An audio summary narrated for the AIEIO Book Library. Cialdini is a professor of psychology and marketing, formerly at Arizona State University, and he wrote this book because he kept getting talked into things. That is his own account of the motivation, and it is not false modesty. He describes himself as a lifelong easy mark, a person who bought magazine subscriptions he did not want, and tickets to charity balls he had no intention of attending. Being an experimental psychologist, he decided to find out why. His method is the reason the book reads the way it does. Laboratory experiments told him a good deal, but he suspected the people who really understood compliance were not academics. They were the practitioners, salespeople, fundraisers, recruiters, advertisers, con artists. So for about 3 years, he went undercover. He answered newspaper advertisements, enrolled in sales training programs, took jobs in telemarketing and door-to-door sales, and sat in the back of rooms where people were taught how to make other people say yes. The result was published in 1984, revised several times, and in the 2021 edition, expanded with a seventh principle. It has sold in the millions, and it is the standard reference on the subject. The core claim is that human beings run on shortcuts. We cannot analyze every situation from first principles, so we use single features of a situation as a proxy for the whole thing, and we respond automatically. Those shortcuts are usually rational and usually save us. And they are exploitable, because anyone who knows which feature triggers which response can supply the feature without the substance. The opening chapter sets up the mechanism, and it is the part people forget while remembering the six principles. Cialdini borrows an image from animal behavior. Ethologists have documented fixed action patterns, elaborate invariant sequences of behavior in animals, triggered reliably by a single specific feature of the environment. A mother turkey will care for anything that makes the cheep cheep sound of a chick, including a stuffed model of a polecat, her natural enemy, if a recorder inside it plays the sound. Switch the recorder off and she attacks it. Cialdini's claim is that human beings have something functionally similar. He calls it click, whir, a trigger feature clicks, and a behavioral tape whirs through. He is careful not to say we are turkeys. His point is subtler and more interesting. The shortcuts exist because they work. Life is too complicated to analyze everything, and a reliable proxy is a good bargain almost all of the time. The problem is only that the proxy can be faked. The classic demonstration is an experiment by Ellen Langer at a library photocopier. Someone tries to cut the queue. With a bare request, may I use the machine? About 60% agree. With a real reason attached, because I am in a rush, 94% agree. And with what she called a placebic reason, because I have to make some copies, which supplies no information whatsoever, 93% agree. The trigger was not the reason. It was the word because. He also introduces the contrast principle, which runs underneath several of the later chapters. We do not perceive quantities absolutely. We perceive them relative to what came just before. Show someone a house that is overpriced and dilapidated, and the next house looks like a bargain. Sell the suit before the sweater, and the sweater seems cheap. Cialdini notes that this is invisible to the person experiencing it, and that it is taught explicitly in sales training. The first and, Cialdini argues, the most powerful of the principles. We feel obliged to repay what we have been given. The rule appears in every human society that has been studied, and there are good reasons for it. It allowed the division of labor, the exchange of goods, and systems of aid and dependency, because a person could give something away without actually losing it. Because it is universal and heavily trained into us from childhood, the feeling of obligation is genuinely uncomfortable to carry, and people will do a good deal to discharge it. The exploitable features are three, and they are worth knowing precisely. The first is that the rule is overpowering. An uninvited favor still creates obligation. In an experiment by Dennis Regan, a stranger who bought someone an unrequested soft drink was afterwards able to sell them substantially more raffle tickets. And, notably, whether the subject liked the stranger stopped mattering. The obligation overrode the preference. The second is that it can trigger uneven exchanges. Because the discomfort of being indebted is unpleasant, and because refusing a gift is socially awkward, a small unsolicited favor can produce a considerably larger return. the Hare Krishna Society's flower pressed into the hand of a traveller who did not want it and could not give it back, is Cialdini's example, and he notes it worked well enough to fund temples. The third is the one most people have not thought about. The rule applies to concessions as well as gifts. If you retreat from a large request to a smaller one, the other person feels obliged to reciprocate your concession by moving toward you. This is rejection, then retreat, also called the door in the face technique, and it is tested with a study in which students asked to chaperone delinquents on a zoo trip agreed at about 17% when asked directly, and at about 50% when the zoo request followed a refused request to counsel delinquents for 2 years. It also, he notes, produces greater satisfaction and greater follow-through than a direct request, because the target feels responsible for the final shape of the deal. The defense is not to refuse all gifts, which would make you a hermit. It is to accept genuine gifts freely and to redefine as a sales device anything that turns out to have been a tactic. At which point the reciprocity rule no longer applies, because the rule says favors are repaid with favors, not with sales tricks. Once we have made a choice or taken a stand, we encounter personal and interpersonal pressure to behave consistently with it. Cialdini's account of why is more useful than the observation itself. Consistency is valued socially. It is often genuinely adaptive, and crucially, it offers a shortcut through complexity. Once a position is fixed, you no longer have to think about the question. That last benefit is also its danger, because it is a very comfortable place to hide from evidence. The lever is commitment. Get someone to take a small step, and the pressure to stay consistent will carry them further. The foundational study is Friedman and Fraser's. Homeowners were asked to allow a large, badly lettered "Drive Carefully" billboard on their front lawn. Around 17% agreed, but among those who 2 weeks earlier had agreed to display a 3-inch sign about safe driving, over 76% agreed. The tiny initial commitment had changed how they saw themselves. They were now the kind of person who does that sort of thing. Cialdini identifies 4 features that make a commitment stick. It should be active rather than passive, meaning the person does something rather than merely agreeing. It should be public, because we are far more consistent with positions others have witnessed. It should require effort, since we value what we have suffered for, which is his explanation for initiation rituals and for the durability of hazing in fraternities and armies. And most importantly, it should feel internally chosen, not coerced, because a commitment made under obvious external pressure produces no change in self-image at all. He draws the parenting conclusion explicitly. Threats and bribes produce compliance while they are present, and no lasting change when they are removed. 2 field tactics follow. The written commitment, used by companies who run testimonial contests, requiring an essay beginning, "Why I like this product." And the lowball, in which a good offer is used to secure a decision, and then the offer is worsened after the person has begun generating their own reasons for the choice. Cialdini says he watched this taught directly in car dealerships. The defense he offers is bodily rather than intellectual. Notice the sensation in your stomach when you are being pushed to be consistent with something you no longer believe. And ask the question that cuts through it. Knowing what I now know, if I could go back in time, would I make the same commitment? We determine what is correct by finding out what other people think is correct. 95% of people are imitators, one advertising executive told him, and only 5% are initiators. Again, the mechanism is usually sound. Following the crowd is a reasonable heuristic, since crowds are often right, and it saves an enormous amount of independent investigation. The failures come in 2 identifiable conditions, and Cialdini names them. The first is uncertainty. When a situation is ambiguous, we look to others, and if everyone is looking at everyone else, the group can settle into a stable state of collective inaction that no individual would have chosen. This is pluralistic ignorance, and it is the mechanism behind the bystander effect. The more witnesses there are to an emergency, the less likely any of them is to help, partly because responsibility is diffused, and partly because everyone reads everyone else's outward calm as evidence that nothing is wrong. His practical advice on this is the single most useful piece of instruction in the book. If you need help in a crowd, do not shout for help generally. Isolate one person, look at them directly, and assign the task specifically. You in the blue jacket, call an ambulance. This converts an ambiguous group situation into a personal obligation. The second condition is similarity. We are most influenced by the behavior of people we perceive as like ourselves. He supports this with the sociologist David Phillips's work on the Werther effect, which found detectable increases in suicides and in single-occupant car and plane crashes in the period following widely publicized suicides, with the pattern tracking the demographics of the reported case. The tactics are everywhere once you see them: canned laughter, which people reliably say they dislike and which reliably works; the salted tip jar; the line outside the club; testimonials from ordinary-looking people rather than experts; and the phrase "fastest growing," which is a claim about other people's behavior rather than about the product. We prefer to say yes to people we like. Obvious in principle, and the value of the chapter, is that Cialdini itemizes exactly what produces liking, because each item is manufacturable. Physical attractiveness produces a halo effect, in which one good attribute leads to assumptions of others. Attractive people are judged more talented, kinder, more honest, and more intelligent, and are given more lenient sentences in some studies. Almost nobody believes this affects them. Similarity in almost any dimension, including opinions, background, dress, and even the small coincidence of a shared name or birthplace. Salespeople are trained to find and mention one. Compliments, which work with startling reliability, even when transparently insincere and even when the person has an obvious motive. Contact and familiarity, though with an important qualifier. Repeated exposure increases liking only when the contact is pleasant. Contact under unpleasant or competitive conditions makes things worse, which is why desegregating schools alone did not reduce prejudice. Cooperation toward a shared goal does. Cialdini uses the jigsaw classroom work here, where children must depend on each other to complete a task, and association, which is the deepest of the five. We are liked or disliked by mere connection to other things. He gives the weather forecaster blamed for the weather, the practice of doing business over lunch so that the proposal is associated with the food, and the phenomenon of basking in reflected glory, where fans say, "We won," and they lost about a team they have never played for, and are more likely to wear the team's colors after a victory. The defense is unusually specific. Do not attempt to monitor the tactics, because there are too many, and they are subtle. Instead, monitor the outcome. If you notice that you have come to like a requester more, or more quickly, than the circumstances warrant, that is the signal. Then mentally separate the person from the deal, and evaluate the deal alone. We are trained from birth that obedience to legitimate authority is correct, and the training goes very deep. Cialdini opens with Stanley Milgram's obedience experiments, in which ordinary volunteers, instructed by a researcher in a lab coat, appeared to deliver what they believed were escalating and eventually dangerous electric shocks to a protesting stranger. Roughly two-thirds went to the maximum. Milgram had asked psychiatrists to predict the result beforehand, and they had estimated about 1 in 1,000. The critical detail, and the one that makes it relevant to persuasion rather than merely to atrocity, is that the researcher had no power over the participants at all. He could not punish them, pay them, or fire them. He simply appeared to be the authority in the room. Cialdini then makes the observation that turns this into a practical warning. Because we respond to authority automatically, we respond to the symbols of authority rather than to the substance, and the symbols can be worn by anyone. He identifies three titles, which are the easiest to claim and which measurably alter how people perceive the same person's height and status. Clothing, where a man in a business suit gets substantially more compliance jaywalking than the same man in casual dress, and a uniform still more. And trappings, cars, offices, jewelry, the visible apparatus of position. His most alarming example is from healthcare, a study in which researchers telephoned hospital wards posing as a physician and instructed nurses to administer an obviously excessive dose of an unauthorized drug, found that the great majority began to comply before being stopped. He pairs it with the case of a prescription for an ear infection, written as "place in our ear," which a nurse and a patient jointly interpreted as an instruction to put eardrops in the patient's rectum, neither of them pausing to ask whether that made sense. The defense is two questions. Is this authority truly an expert in the relevant matter? And how truthful can I expect this expert to be here, given what they stand to gain? Opportunities seem more valuable when their availability is limited. Two reasons. The first is that difficulty of acquisition is usually a decent proxy for quality, so scarcity is another reasonable shortcut. The second is deeper and does most of the work. As things become less available, we lose freedom, and we hate losing freedoms we already have. That is psychological reactance, and Cialdini treats it as the engine of the whole chapter. Reactance shows up early. The terrible twos are, in this reading, a child's first sustained encounter with the discovery that their freedoms are limited. It also explains the Romeo and Juliet effect, where parental interference in a young relationship intensifies it. And it explains something politically important. Censorship reliably increases desire for the censored material, and in some studies, makes people more sympathetic to the banned position without their having read it. Cialdini's advice to anyone with information they cannot suppress is that suppression is the strongest possible endorsement. Two conditions amplify scarcity considerably. The first is that newly experienced scarcity is more potent than constant scarcity. Something that has just become restricted is far more desirable than something that has always been rare. He observes that this is why periods of improving conditions, followed by a sudden reversal, are historically associated with revolution, rather than periods of unrelieved deprivation. The second is competition. Scarcity plus visible rivals produces something close to frenzy, which is the mechanic of the auction, the queue, and the property open house scheduled so that all the buyers arrive at once. The defense is the hardest in the book, because reactance is arousal rather than reasoning, and you cannot out-argue your own adrenaline. Cialdini's suggestion is to use the arousal itself as the alarm. When you notice the surge, stop and ask what you actually want the thing for. If it is to use it, then the scarcity is irrelevant to its usefulness. If it is simply to have it because it might run out, you are being played, added in the 2021 edition, and Cialdini argues it is distinct from liking, rather than a variant of it. Liking is about people who are similar to us. Unity is about people we consider to be, in some sense, part of us. The relevant question is, not do we resemble one another, but are we of the same thing? Shared identities that create this include family and kinship, place of origin, ethnicity and nationality, and membership of a group in which the individual and the group are experienced as overlapping. Two categories create it. The first is being together, kinship, and the surprisingly strong effects of shared locality. Language of family, used outside the family, the phrase "we are like family here," works because it borrows the response due to actual kinship. The second is acting together. Synchronous and coordinated activity, marching, singing, moving in time, produces a measurable increase in cooperation and mutual liking, including in experiments with young children. And co-creation, when people build something together, the resulting bond and sense of shared ownership is much stronger than when one party merely receives the other's work. Cialdini notes that asking someone for advice rather than their opinion invites them into a co-creative posture and reliably increases their subsequent commitment. Unity is the principle most obviously double-edged, since the same mechanism that produces solidarity within a group produces indifference or hostility toward those outside it. And Cialdini is more explicit about the ethical hazard here than anywhere else in the book. Cialdini is aware he has written a manual, and he handles it better than most authors in this position. His framing is that the principles are not tricks. They are genuine features of how human beings work, and each of them can be used honestly. If your product really is scarce, saying so is information. If you genuinely are an expert, presenting your credentials is helpful. If a customer really would benefit from what others chose, telling them the truth about that is a service. Cialdini's position is that the ethical line is not the use of the principle, but whether the trigger corresponds to something real. He calls the dishonest use smuggling, importing a trigger that is not naturally present in the situation. Manufactured deadlines, fake scarcity, invented credentials, insincere flattery. His argument against it is partly moral and partly practical. In any relationship that continues, a discovered smuggle destroys trust and the cost exceeds the sale. And his advice for defense is consistent across all seven chapters and worth stating on its own. Do not try to detect tactics, because there are too many and the practitioners are better at it than you. Instead, watch for the moment the automatic response fires, the flush of obligation, the pull to be consistent, the sensation of everyone else doing it, the surge of wanting because something is running out. Treat that feeling as the alarm, and treat the alarm as permission to stop and evaluate the offer on its merits alone. This book has been enormously influential, and it needs reading with some care because parts of its evidence base have not held up. The replication problem is the big one. Social psychology has been through a decade of failed replications, and this book is built almost entirely on classic social psychology experiments from the 1960s to the 1980s, an era with small samples, flexible analysis, and strong publication bias. Some of the studies cited here have replicated well. Others have not been retested at modern standards, and effect sizes in the field have generally shrunk on re-examination. The direction of most of the findings is probably right. The magnitude implied by the anecdotes very likely is not. The Milgram material needs qualification. The obedience studies remain among the most cited in the discipline. But Gina Perry's archival work showed the procedure was far less standardized than reported, that the experimenter improvised pressure well beyond the scripted prods, and that a substantial number of participants indicated afterwards that they had doubted the shocks were real. The headline finding survives in weakened form. The clean version told in popular books does not. The Kitty Genovese case, which frames the bystander discussion, is largely a journalistic myth. The original New York Times account of 38 witnesses who watched and did nothing has been substantially discredited. Several people did call the police, at least one came to her aid, and most of the alleged witnesses could not have seen the attack. The bystander effect itself does replicate reasonably well in the laboratory, so the science survives, but the story that made it famous does not. The anecdotes do too much work. This is the mild irony of the book. It is extremely persuasive, and its persuasiveness comes substantially from vivid stories rather than from effect sizes. A reader finishes it far more confident about the strength of these effects than the underlying data would justify. And the cultural range is narrow. The research is almost entirely from Western, educated, industrialized samples. Cialdini has since acknowledged that the relative power of the principles varies across cultures, with consistency weighing more heavily in individualist societies and social proof more heavily in collectivist ones. What survives all of that is still considerable. The central insight that people run on triggers and that triggers can be supplied without the substance behind them is correct and important. The taxonomy is genuinely useful and has not been improved on in 40 years. And the defensive advice, watch for the automatic response rather than trying to spot the tactic, is good practical guidance that does not depend on any particular study holding up. The reason to read this book is not to become better at getting your way. Plenty of readers do use it that way, and Cialdini's follow-up, Persuasion, is more openly aimed at practitioners. The better reason is the one he started with. He wrote it because he kept saying yes to things he did not want, and he wanted to know why. What the book gives you is a vocabulary for a set of experiences you have already had many times without being able to name them. The sense of owing someone you did not ask anything from. The reluctance to abandon a position you no longer believe. The reassurance of a crowd, the peculiar authority of a uniform, the urgency that arrives when something is about to run out. Naming those is genuinely protective. Not because you will stop feeling them, since you will not, but because a feeling with a name attached is a feeling you can decide what to do about. That was the summary of Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion by Robert Cialdini. This narration is an original summary and commentary. It is not a substitute for the book. And if it caught you, read the real thing. From the AIIO Book Library, thank you for listening.